and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. World-renowned systemic therapist, best-selling author, professor, researcher, and the creator of Emotionally Focused Therapy, EFT. She's also an amazing partner, an incredible mother, gardener, tango dancer, lover of nature, and student of history. I'm talking about Sue Johnson. She lived with cancer for 3 years, and on April 23rd, 2024, that journey ended. So today, we hearken back to one of our best guests on the AMFT podcast, Sue Johnson, talking about her humble origins and the legacy of her career in her own words from a few years ago in her time with me, and two people that knew her best, her friends and colleagues, Jim Furrow and Gail Palmer, will, in a heartfelt way, talk about the legacy and their memories of their friend, Sue. So sit back and enjoy a very special tribute episode of the AAMFT podcast to Dr. Susan Johnson. Okay, I am pleased to be joined here on the podcast by Dr. Sue Johnson, the founder of Emotionally Focused Therapy. And we're going to learn a lot about Sue today. And as we do on the AMFT interview segment on the podcast, really the person behind the model. Sue, everybody, even before they have the language of family systems, think systemically. And one of the questions we always ask people to start out, how did you decide to become a couple and family therapist?
I think that's an interesting question because I don't think I decided to become a couple and family therapist. I'd done a lot of things before I even started seeing couples. I'd seen families in the treatment center I was working in, and that was fascinating. And I'd done a lot of individual therapy and a lot of groups with various different kinds of people. But what happened was that at a certain point in my training, I was in a clinic and they said, what we want you to do is see couples on the hour, every hour, for as long as you can manage it, maybe about 3 days. And I was so silly that I wasn't even, so naive that I wasn't even daunted by that. I said, sure. And then I started seeing couples, and I was completely, totally, I was fascinated, appalled, totally caught by the dramas they were in, totally caught by the vulnerability that I saw in both people, which they did not see in each other, totally fascinated by how suddenly, I knew that what I was watching was universal, was incredibly important in people's lives. I knew that it was what I saw my parents struggle with when I was young. Then it defeated them both, and it had a terrible impact on my father's life, who was really my main attachment figure in my life. And I was just caught by it, and I thought, okay. I was also appalled by my incompetence. I didn't know what to do. I dashed out to the library and I read Neil Jacobson talking about teaching people communication skills. I read the analytic people talking about collusion and all this kind of stuff. I was a Rogerian already, so I knew how to listen to people. And after a few weeks, I just threw all those folks out of the window and said, okay, I don't know how to help these folks, and I don't think anyone else does either. So maybe I should just start by letting my clients teach me. I'll just start taping my sessions. And I got hooked. And here I am all these years later, I'm still hooked. I still feel excited when I hear a couple coming down the hall that I haven't seen before. I'm still eager to find out what they're going to show me, what they're going to teach me. I'm still hooked. So that's really what happened.
Yeah, clearly your passion comes through. Anybody that's seen you speak or work with couples, that you're just as excited about the work now as you were back then. Give us some, for kind of historical purposes, the timeline. Where are we talking about? Where were you? Were you at York during this time, or where were you when you started working with couples, and yeah, the place and the year?
Okay. I was in Vancouver on the west coast of Canada, which is where I am now. I just moved back. I've moved back from the east coast. Now I'm on Vancouver Island in a lovely little town called Victoria. But I was in Vancouver. I'd come from England a few years before. I was doing a doctorate in counseling psychology at the University of Vancouver U, right? And I was struggling with how to get through the program, how to figure out a thesis, what did I really want to do in psychology? I was struggling with that. So this was a clinic. I can't even remember the name of it now. This was a small clinic downtown. And theoretically, I was only supposed to have to see three couples to complete my clinical training. That didn't work. The clinic was having a hard time. There were a lot of people sick. And they said to me, "You're quite experienced. If you don't mind, we got 3 days from you. And we want you to see all these couples we can't handle." So that's where I was. And I was sharp in, I think the other thing about it was I was really looking for something that really grabbed me. I'd already got a thesis mapped out for me, and I was bored by it already. And I think I was...
What was that on, Sue? What was that original thesis on before you started taping yourself with these couples?
It was something about process of change in individual therapy. And it was, my advisor was Les Greenberg, and he's basically an individual therapist. He's a Rogerian. And he said, "This is what I think you should do." And nothing happened for me. It was like, okay, is that what I'm going to do? Then I started seeing these couples and working with them and writing out the transcripts of the sessions, if you can believe it, taping them, writing them out, looking at what worked and what didn't. And it wasn't terribly long before I felt emotion, just focusing on the emotion and the drama and understanding the drama, looking at the patterns in the drama, something was starting to gel. And I was doing things and I suddenly felt, oh my God, look, I'm making a difference. So we started writing it down. And I thought, what I want to do for my thesis is test if this stuff works, which in hindsight was completely insane. Okay. I was a doctoral student. I was working part-time in order to eat. It was insane for me to try and write a manual of what I was doing and then to try and do a real rigorous study.
Right. So that would actually go on to become your dissertation and the first outcome study on EFT. What year was that, Sue?
In 86, right? And it was insane. When I look back on it now, I've done a lot of research studies since then. That doctoral dissertation was putting together what we had come up couples from a little manual that was about 8 pages, taking some therapists who would agree to work with me, looking at our tape, trying to figure out what we're doing. And I persuaded Neil Jacobson to do another group with the clinical psychology students who already knew how to do behavioral stuff. He sent a trainer up and we got these couples in and we randomly assigned them half to a waiting list, a third to a waiting list, a third to EFT, and a third to Neil Jacobson's BMT. And we tested it. And it was crazy and it nearly killed me. In fact, at one point my doctor said, "You've lost a lot of weight and you're getting sick. And if you keep losing weight, I don't care what you're doing in your career, I'm going to put you in the hospital. So that's how exhausting it was. I did the whole study in 7 months. I was on fire. I was enthralled by the fact that we seemed to have found something. We were making a difference for these couples. They were having these knock-your-socks-off conversations, which we call softenings or hold-me-tight conversations now. They were having these conversations that were just moving and seemed to not just change the relationship, but change how they saw themselves. It was, I thought, this is something. I don't know what I've plugged into here, but this is powerful.
You know, the field of couple therapy has followed a parallel path as traditional family therapy, where your traditional family therapist, they wanted to study behavior. In fact, originally the MRI group, what happened in the black box, i.e. emotion, cognition, they thought that would inhibit change. And if you were getting trained in couples therapy, you were getting trained in behavioral marital therapy. Now what we know is traditional couples behavioral therapy. And you knew something was there. So by watching these couples and inducting the model from what you saw, you tapped into this emotional experience. Now, emotions, was that always how you were geared to look at people and relationships, or did it really hit you after watching those tapes?
No, I think I was already there. The thing about me was I had a very strange childhood. I grew up in an English pub.
Yes, I've heard you allude to that, but and your mom was a barmaid, correct? Or did she run the bar?
She was a barmaid and she was in charge of the pub. She was the big cheese. She was the one that all the guys were afraid of. Not my dad, who was a great big guy, but he was very quiet and calm. My mother was like a firecracker. If you upset her, you never knew what was going to happen. But the point was, I was given a task. I was stood on a stool and taught how to wash glasses. Nobody thought, oh, Sue's a child, she shouldn't be in a pub. That wasn't the way it worked in that culture in those days. English pubs in those days were like more like community centers in some ways. Everybody went there every day to talk and be together, right?
Are those your earliest memories, like growing up doing that?
Yeah, like I'm standing on a stool and I'm dunking the glasses in the water and dunking them in the rinse water and wiping them and putting them on a shelf. And as I'm doing this, I'm watching adults flirt, fight, have huge discussions, get drunk. And there were some traumatized folks there because it was a naval pub. Everyone was in the Navy. It was years after the war, but there was still a whole bunch of upset folks in there. And it was like circus.
And I so like as a little girl, are you aware that like this culture and everything, other young people are not experiencing what you're experiencing? Is this like a whole new world for you, or does this make you like grow up quickly? Or how did growing up in that bar impact your way you viewed your parents and relationships?
I think, first of all, it made it so that emotion was never intimidating for me. And I was used to it. And also, I think even back then, I watched so many real life dramas that I already started to pick up that there were patterns in these dramas. I would watch people come in and say the exact same thing to my father every night and him say the exact same thing back. So it wasn't rocket science that this wasn't about the content of the conversation. This was about something else. This was about, I don't think I could have said it's about connection, but I was already totally comfortable with intense interpersonal dramas and emotion growing up as a child. And then I was sent to talk about two different worlds, talk about understanding that realities, there's more than one reality. I was sent to school with very conservative Roman Catholic nuns who added to that repertoire, taught me to think. They taught me to argue and reason and question and think about everything. So I had this sort of parallel thing of one group of people teaching me how to question and think for myself in a very sophisticated way. I didn't realize until I'd grown up how sophisticated those nuns were. And then on the other hand, I was immersed in these ongoing emotional dramas. So I think that was part of what resonated for me when I started to see couples. There was part of it that I didn't understand, but there was part of it that was like, oh, this is, I remember this. This is, I always knew that the emotion was the music and that there was a dance going on between these people that wasn't being captured by any of the behavioral stuff or the analytic stuff. I always knew that. And I always knew that the emotion is what drove the dance between people because I watched it in the pub.
Yeah, you watched it in the pub and then you saw it unfold in the therapy room. Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you learned a lot from observing your parents. What did, you know, I always say, we only know two relationships, that and the one that we're in, and our blueprint, which usually comes from our family of origin. So as much as you're comfortable, I guess, describe what you learned about your parents' relationship and the type of relationship you went on to have as a young adult with your mother and father. And I'm also curious what they think of what you have done with your career.
I think it was very clear to me. Two things were very clear to me. And I think I said this in my book, Love Sense, actually. Two confusing things were very clear to me. It was clear to me that my parents mattered to each other a lot and they loved each other. And it was clear to me that they were destroying each other. And I remember sitting on the stairs as a child. And I think my granny came to sit beside me because she lived with us all the time I was growing up. She was wonderful. And she came to sit beside me because I was sitting on the stairs crying, listening to my parents fight. And when you look back on it now, they had a completely plastic, criticized, demand, enraged, followed by shut down, dismiss, withdraw, dance in their relationship. My dad would simply stop talking. And my mother would just spiral into more and more hysterical rage.
Mom was the pursuer and dad was the distancer.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And don't forget that dad joined the Navy at some ridiculous age, lied about his age, joined the Navy at 50 and had spent almost his whole life before he took over this pub fighting in various wars and being on ships with men. I don't think anyone ever helped him understand anything really about women.
Sue, did you have siblings or were you the only child?
I was the only one.
So did you get triangulated into their dance?
No, I don't think I did. And I don't quite know why. Perhaps it was because I always had my granny to be with, who was amazingly safe and very calm. I think I got a bit triangulated when I was an adolescent. But not as a child. My mother was amazingly busy. She was running this pub and she could be warm and wonderful and she could also be dangerous as hell. And I think that helped me tune into the traumatized folks I see where, you know, people you love can be the source of fear and the solution to fear. And sometimes that is a real paradox for you. My mom was like that. I was amazingly close to my father all my life. And what is miraculous to me is that I don't think he ever read a book on attachment. I know he didn't. I'm not sure about the relationship he had with my grandparents. I've never been clear about them. But somehow, this man knew how to be the most amazing father. I mean, he was... If John Bowlby, the father of attachment theory, had watched my dad interact with me, I think he would have been blown away. And you only realize it when you've grown up that he was an amazing father. He was given secure base.
Isn't it amazing that when I work with couples, that they cannot do it with each other. They cannot show this vulnerability or create these connections, but they can do it with their kids. And your dad was the same way. He might have not have been able to do it with your mother, but he had a way to securely connect to you and throughout your whole life. Now, was mom, sometimes parents that don't have that connection with their kids, they, even if they can't articulate it in words, they're jealous or they feel like they're missing out. Do you think mom was envious of that connection that you had with your father and also your grandmother.
Maybe. But I think the key thing about my mom and me was that, and this is hindsight after a decade, but we really lived on different planets. My mom was born in a little village. She was working class. She considered life to be a fight for survival, where you had to work every minute and you had to claw your way up, maybe into the middle class, but at least into survival. And I didn't realize until after she died, which is ridiculous when you think about it, that she was almost illiterate. And by a load of accidents, which we won't get into, okay, but by a series of accidents, because my family were quite poor, I ended up being sent to this Catholic private school where I was educated by these sophisticated, educated women. I was lapping up novels. I was being taught what I think about now as philosophy. They called it Christian doctrine, but really it was philosophy I was being taught. I was in this other world. And then when I came back to the pub, it was like my mom didn't know how to deal with that. We would have arguments. By the time I was about 10, we were having arguments where my mom would say, "What are you doing? What are you doing? Your nose out of that book. Where do you think that book learning is going to get you? That's not going to get you anywhere." And I would resent this, of course, and I'd do what I was told and then go away and read somewhere else. Whereas my father loved it that I was getting an education. I have a picture of him when I got my degree. I was early all through the school system. I got my degree by the time I was 20, which is pretty early. And I have a picture of him when I got my degree with my cap and gown on. And he is a picture of complete pride. And he adored that I was reading great big books and that I could argue and that I could even argue with people in the pub. And my mother was pulled. She said, You've got to work harder. You should learn how to be a hairdresser.
So it's interesting because your mother, that part of her that made her tough and resilient and probably was her survival mechanism working in the pub, it's counter to showing vulnerability that we think of, certainly when we think of EFT. So in some ways, she was proud of you, but couldn't relate to you since she had a really different experience. But your father could understand and was really thrilled you were getting this experience. As for someone that went through 12 years of Catholic schooling, I can certainly relate to your story and how that shaped you and your work ethic. I am curious, as you progressed and became both a stellar researcher and clinician, did your mother, and I don't know when she passed away, did your mother get it? Did she understand your impact on the field?
No, I don't think she did. I think it was completely mysterious to her. I think it was just too far from where she lived. And I think in some ways, I think she resented. It was almost like I'd left her world. I'd chosen another world, a world she didn't understand. Being a professor, I heard her talk over the fence to a neighbor once. I can't remember how old I was when I was an adult. He was explaining to this neighbor that I was a psychiatrist. And I thought I should correct her. I thought, no, it's all right. It doesn't matter. And she was telling this neighbor that I was very important and I earned a lot of money. And I thought, oh, okay, she doesn't. Because that's what mattered to her. She would always tell me, you must earn money. And I think it influenced me my whole life because I have some sort of defiant part of me. By the time I was an adolescent, I was quite a defiant little kid. Okay. One of my defiant things in my family was my mother would say, the only thing that matters in life is money. And I would say, I refuse. I will not live my life out of that. I'm not going to care about money. I'm going to do what I want to do in life. I'm not going to care about money. And it sounds abstract, but then her and I would get into one hell of a fight right? And she's saying, you know, you're stupid and you don't understand life. And we'd fight. But the time I was an adolescent, my parents had split up, stayed with my dad and my granny. And when my mom and I would get together, she was a very dominant lady. And I think I got a lot of what people have called my irreverence, I don't know what you call it.
You're reading my mind. I was going to ask you how that barmaid part of you comes out and manifests itself both in your personal, but also in your clinical work. And maybe it does come out as that irreverent in the moment type of way. But also you are tough and you've also been successful. So in some ways, most model developers, one of their common factors is their belief in what they're doing and their ability to get other people excited about the work. And your mother would certainly, even if she is not a foreign to the world of couple or family therapy, she would certainly have to acknowledge your success. Was she around enough to see that?
No, not really. I think my father was proud of me. I think, you know, for him, the idea that I was doing a doctorate and that I remember exactly what I was doing when he died, I think he was very proud of me. And I think he would be proud of me now, right? Whereas I think if my mom was alive now, she'd still be puzzled. She said to me the last time I was with her, I'd come to Canada, which she also disapproved of. I'd left England, which was crime from her point of view. One of the last times she was here, she told me that even though I was happy doing what I was doing, in fact, it was a tragedy that I hadn't stayed in my little hometown in England to become a hairdresser.
So flash forward, when you see someone like your mom, whether it's a male or female in your office or in a couples therapy session, when you have an interface issue, a client that reminds you of that kind of rigid, tough exterior that your mom had, how do you deal with that in a therapy room?
I just see how afraid they are. And I think that's the secret to working with aggressive people, period. You know, I've worked with a lot of vets. I've worked with violent men in groups. I've worked with a lot of very escalated couples. And I guess the thing with aggression, I think it's particularly important to have this perspective when people get aggressive with you as a therapist. The place I always go, and I guess I must have seen this with my mother at some, it must have happened with my mother. We're all caught when somebody gets hostile with us. There's a moment of, because we're human and being criticized or being attacked hurts. We're human beings. But then for me, that moment after you're caught is I'm telling you a thought, but it's more like a visceral reaction. Before the aggression, there's a threat. And so I always go to what is the fear? And it's interesting because I think my mother is still maybe the person in my life who I can still say I don't really understand, even though I think about her or I reflect on her. She was a very complex person. She was a little fighter, and she was working class, uneducated woman, and she was a little fighter. And there was part of that I respect, and she gave me that too. I'm a little fighter in the end. Like somebody once said, what was it? One of my students said to me, oh, I met somebody the other day and told them I work with you. And they said, oh, Stu Jonathan must be this hardly warm grandmothery figure. And I said, you know, what did you say to them? And my student roared with laughter. She said, no, Stu Jonathan isn't like that at all. Stu Jonathan's out there and pretty powerful and says what she thinks and can stand up to people and she could be aggressive. And that's right. I have my mother's fighter in me.
Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast, a very special installment today. We are talking about the memory of the late, great Sue Johnson, couple therapy pioneer, emotionally focused therapy, and had to have two people to talk about Sue that know her just as well as anyone, a longtime friends, collaborators, Jim Furrow and Gail Palmer. So guys, let's start. Tell us when and how you met Sue, and we'll go from there.
All right, maybe I'll jump in. I met Sue. I was a social worker at the outpatient psychiatry clinic at the Ottawa Hospital. And this was 1988. And Sue came in to lead our family therapy team. So I think I've known her. I know I've known her longer than I didn't know her. I was only 34 years old at the time. And she was fresh out of UBC in terms of her degree, and had come to Ottawa to be the professor at the university there.
Yeah, I think she defended her dissertation, which was the first EFT outcome study with Les Greenberg in 1986. So you met her very early on into her professional career and her journey into EFT. What about you, Jim?
Sue, about 10 years later, I was in a faculty position. A doctoral student, Brent Bradley, who has now become a colleague, both of us were very interested in EFT. And one of the questions that we were struggling with in trying to take what Sue had written and watching her work was, how do you do a blamer softening? How do you make this pursuer softening event happen? And we were struggling. It's one of the most difficult parts of the model. And so Brent said, we should just call Sue Johnson. We should ask for her help. And I was a bit reluctant. This is a field leader. How do you just ring them up and ask them to help? And this is just Sue Johnson. Brent made the call. We talked with her. Soon we were meeting together. Next, we were doing this study together. She opened her work to us. She opened her heart to us. And that started a 20 plus year relationship with someone who's shaped my life professionally and deeply as a person as well.
Yeah, my experience of Sue was, met her about 20 years ago in my doctoral program with Doug Sprinkle, the late great Doug Sprinkle, who was a purveyor of the common factors in the field. But one of his favorite models, certainly with working with couples, was EFT, and so is mine. So it was a similar story. We'd watched all those classic training tapes. Maybe some will mention today. I'm thinking of the simulated clients that probably everybody's seen, Mark and Prue. And it's probably, that was filmed probably right around the time Gail met her. Hey, we were in this advanced doctoral practicum where we were studying EFT. Doug was like, let's just call her. And we're like, we can call Sue Johnson and three or four doctoral students. And sure enough, we did. And if you were interested in the model, she was ready to talk. So my memories of Sue were, what you saw is what you got. She was very passionate about all things EFT. And certainly, I think, and I'm curious what you guys think, part of the biggest success of the model is, I mean, she was a true believer and she was the best ambassador for the model. And now we have Jim and Gales and countless other people that will carry on the torch, which I'm also curious about today. But I think Sue was really authentic, and what you saw is what you got. And you guys knew her well, personally and professionally. So let's tell some stories of maybe the Sue. Everybody knows about the three stages and the nine steps. Everybody knows she was both a scientist and practitioner. But let's talk about some of the things maybe people don't know, and really what you will remember as far as Sue the person.
So Sue opened her heart not only to other professionals, but to her client. We met every Tuesday morning and would see a new couple or a new family together as a family therapy team at the hospital. And these clients would come in to be viewed in front of a one-way mirror. And the team would sit behind and there'd be a phone in the room and Sue would call and everyone would jump. And that's how I learned EFT. But what she did was she made everyone feel totally safe. Folks would come in and Sue would greet them in the waiting room, and she'd kneel down and she'd get eye-to-eye contact and let them know it's perfectly safe. They're going to be okay. We're going to look after you and we're going to help. And then people would take these risks and share with one another and be inspired to work on the relationship. And so it extended not just to the academic world or the professional world, but to everyone she worked with.
Yeah, it's been stunning for me in the conversations I've had since her passing to talk to people who knew her well, but also people who knew her work well, but never had met her. And there's a common refrain that you hear, that Sue has touched my life. And there is a way in which her unique capacity to connect, you could, I can remember back in 2009 at an AMFT conference, just the, she gave a keynote address there, and just the vibrancy of her message and how that was reflected in the audience's response and the power of that moment was all around connection. And Sue is so full of life, and you saw that in a variety of different ways, or at least I did, thinking about a recent memory of walking on she and John share a place on Saturna Island, which is in just east of Victoria Island where they live. And it's this beautiful wooded, secluded island. And she took us out on one of her nature walks. And as we were walking with her, she would stop every few feet and point to this species of fungus and this flower that you could hardly see, but she was wide-eyed and fully aware, fully present to the experience that she was inviting us into. And I think that colored, that just made sense to me with her and conversations around research and conversations around clinical work. It's just this full life awareness and presence and curiosity, a voracious curiosity to see and understand and engage her world.
I know, that's so beautifully said. It is, you know, something you said also resonated with me. That's when I show, when I've been training therapists, MFTs and LCSWs for the last 20 years. And luckily in my career, being stuck between, I was trained by original first generation family therapists. People listen to this show know my background, and the bridge between the classic way of working in the new way. And Sue really is also both. She always had a respect for these experiential models that came from past, but she was always looking toward the future to collaborate, to brand her model and spread it on. But my students really do resonate with her in a way that, like, it isn't, as you were saying, they'd never met her. They've seen the source material. And I think that's also because she was so willing to show her work. And whereas some model developers, they're in their ivory tower, they're focused on their promulgating the research behind it. But Sue was in the trenches doing the work and loved to show her work. And I think that is also what helped her resonate with people that didn't even know her. I'm curious what you think about that, Gail, because she is, in my experience, just who people remember when I train them on couples therapy models and classic family therapy models. Sue Johnson has some of the greatest impact on young clinicians learning to do the work.
Yeah, and you know, what strikes me about what you're saying, Eli, is that she started at a time in family therapy or in couple therapy where the emphasis was all on behavior. And emotion was something that you stayed away from. And if you actually encountered emotion, it needed to be managed.
The dreaded black box, yes.
Managed and controlled, right? So she was like swimming upstream to really say, we're going to focus on this, right? We're going to focus on emotion because that's where change happens. And then she gave meaning to the emotion through attachment, right? And what attachment theory and attachment science has taught us. Those two elements, right? One thing I hear from people learning the model is that, oh, this makes so much sense. It just resonates with how we see each other, how we see ourselves. It gets to the heart of the matter. What really matters is our connection to others. And that's what Sue spoke to. And the way she spoke to it, she spoke from her heart. She told stories. She was real, right? And those conferences, Jim, right? When she would stand up at AMFT conferences and she would begin and she would say, hi, everybody, I'm Sue. And that's exactly, you know, the way she related. So it was not only her model, but how she embodied the model we talk about people walking the talk, and certainly Sue did that.
Yeah, the legend is that back in the day when behavioral marital therapy was the state of the art, and Neil Jacobson invited Sue down for a, I guess she was a doctoral student, I believe, at the time. And she was doing this research with Les Greenberg and doing this innovation around couples work. And she gave a presentation. And after the presentation, the story goes that they were out at a bar, probably she would call it a pub. And they were talking about her talk, and there was a bit of a heated exchange. And at one point she took her glass and brought it down hard on the bar and said, "It's not about bargains. It's about bonds, relational bonds, relational connections." And obviously she was contrasting an attachment perspective with a social exchange perspective. But she was really inviting in a way at the very beginning. And I love the fact that if you go back into the Journal of Marriage and Family Therapy in the 1980s, you'll find an article called Bargains and Bonds that she wrote that really was her first toe in the water into the field that began this big journey that has shaped the lives of thousands of therapists and thousands upon thousands of couples.
And she had to do that, you know, in terms of being able to educate others by getting on plane. And she just hated flying, and she had to battle panic to get on all these planes in the beginning and fly to these little small centers. Anyone that wanted to hear about EFT, Sue was willing to go against everything in her body that says, "No, I don't want to do this." So that was that, and staying up half the night writing when her kids were small. She would put them to bed, and then her night would begin with writing. So a lot of hours of sacrifice and hard work just to bring to all of us a way to work with people that actually makes a difference. And yeah, I think that's a gift that she gave.
And I appreciate you telling that story, Gail, or giving that perspective, because I think one of the things that often people don't realize, especially from the persona and impact that she has, is how dedicated she was to her family and how important her children were to her and John was to her, and the special place that they held. And as a mother then, to be a field leader, I was just recently listening to a conversation I had. It was another interview where she was talking about one thing that people don't realize, that I'm a feminist, and I have been. And I think, you know, and maybe you could speak to this, Gail, but just the she came into this field and that was male dominated, and she came into this world of academics and blazed a trail, not only as a woman, but also as a woman speaking about the power of emotion.
Yeah, think of, I want your perspective on it, Gail, but for our listeners who know the history of marriage and family therapy, we were talking about the 80s here, after all these first generation models where there was male dominated and usually white male model developers, mother bashing. Everybody knows about the schizophrenogenic mother. And then in the 80s, there is the feminist critique. And I remember when I talked to Sue many times, and again on the podcast, that she was proud. She was a strong female, and it needed somebody like that in the time for couple therapy. But the time of which she broke out really was crucial in the field's history, and really a parallel process to what was going on in our country. But certainly the field needed a strong female voice that could talk about emotion. And certainly that was Sue.
I think it really speaks to, we talk about Sue's warmth, we talk about her openness, we talk about her heart, but she was also fierce. And she had a grit that allowed her to keep going when people would try to battle her down. And I remember at the hospital that the psychiatrists all got together and thought that the family therapy team was inefficient and needed to be dissolved. And my response was, oh, what do we do to please them? Sue was having none of that, right? She found the research, she got the data, she wrote a letter, she not only wrote it to the people that were talking about dissolving the team, but to the head of the hospital, and she fought. And I don't think EFT would be where it is today without that part of her character.
And when you have grit and you are a fierce bulldog in the way she was, which I think anybody that knew her knew those parts of her too, it means you make enemies along the way too. And I think Sue was willing to be herself no matter what, to push what she believed and the power of emotionally focused therapy. But that doesn't come with everybody liking you. And I wonder if you guys can speak to that, how Sue dealt with her detractors over the years.
I think she gathered a community, don't you think, Jim?
Absolutely. Absolutely. She had colleagues who, she didn't work alone. She took this attachment perspective to heart and how she worked, whether that was collaborating with people like Jim Cohn, a neuroscientist at the University of Virginia, or working with John and Julie Gottman. And there are ways in which she had her own community of people that understood her, as well as all of her colleagues in this work that she so generously invited us to be part of.
So that this was not just something that existed in Canada or in North America, but communities that spread across the world.
Yeah, for sure. EFT is global. And I think another thing that people don't fully appreciate about Sue is that she was a true scientist practitioner. Her model for funding her research is very different than how they do it now, but she used to her advantage in Canada and got many fundamental outcome studies. So we think of EFT, I think of the art and the science of EFT, and certainly it is one of our most empirically supported forms of couple therapy. And for many of our frontline listeners, they just care that it works. But this was truly what I call an efficacious and effective treatment. And Sue was every bit the scientist. She wanted to do it the right way. And she wanted, one of my mentor, Doug Sprinkles, would say MFT's issues is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so that in the golden era of family therapy, you could do these live dazzling demos and you didn't need a proof other than that your model worked. Sue could certainly do live dazzling demos, but she also wanted a seat at the table, and she has the research to back up the power of EFTs. I just think that is another important part of her legacy, is that she was a true scientist practitioner. What are your old thoughts on that?
Certainly in Canada also, we don't have these big research grants. It wasn't something that she was funded by, but rather these research projects came out of the university and the hospital. And at the hospital with the family therapy team, there was a group of volunteers. In Ottawa, Canada, the family therapy team reached the notoriety that every therapist in the community wanted to be part of it and volunteer their time and come and work. And she had therapists to actually execute these research studies, and the energy that it took, right? She would be involved in one project and be thinking about the next. And so her end was never ending. She was always wanting to look at EFT and apply it in all the different, with different client populations, with different presenting problems. And for Jim and I, the first family research was done at the Civic Hospital in 1988, comparing FFT, the family modality, with the traditional ways of treating eating disorders.
Yeah, and I think the grit also showed up, Eli, and what you're saying is that she found the funding she needed to do the studies that were warranted to answer the questions that were emerging as this model rolled out. And often the funding came from her own work, her own tapes, her own books. She put her money where her ideas were. She put investment over and over again in answering the questions that were needed to continue to build the confidence in this model that she believed in wholeheartedly.
Wholeheartedly. She was all in, and I appreciate you sharing that, because when you believe in something, you put everything you have into it. And certainly she did, using her own proceeds to to fund her research, a very untraditional model, but it got her where she needed to be. So when we think, guys, about the future of the model, you all, I look to you all, you were my top two choices to talk about her. But, and I asked her this legacy question a couple years ago when we interviewed her on the podcast, but what do you think is the future of EFT? And you can talk about your own role in that, because you are at the forefront, whether it be working with couples or families. So what is the future of the model without Sue Johnson?
I think her contribution through her life text, the attachment theory and practice, that looked at EFT as one model, three modalities, is really the future of EFT, because it's more than an intervention, it's foundational, that you can look at change happening with your clients, whether they're an individual, a couple, or a family, and apply interventions in all three modalities that are going to affect change. I was teaching in Oxford, England, and the psychologists were finishing their graduate program. And at the end of this four-day externship, one of the students stood up and she said, "You know what? In my studies, I've learned all of these different interventions that are like tools for my tool belt. But EFT is a tool shank, and I'm moving in and I'm buying flowers." And I just thought, that's it, right? It's so foundational in terms of understanding human behavior in a way that actually creates change on a really fundamental level, right? In terms of how we feel about ourselves, right? Our own lovability, our own our own competence, and our relationship with others, how available others are, how much we can trust, how much we can lean and depend on others. And when you think about traveling in life, to have those two aspects more secure is what resources us all. So I think really that's the future in terms of the development, further development of all three modalities. And Jim and I are passionate about family, the application of EFT with family.
I think such an important question. One of the things that comes to mind, I love this story, Gail, and I love that it captured, that metaphor speaks to really the heart of the matter about the ways that this EFT model is in some ways why we might address skills. It's not about skills, it's about capacity. And it's about people's innate ability. And what is the nature of the importance of relationship to humanity? Sue set a course. She was a catalyst. She would say, "I'm not a guru. EFT is not a guru model." But obviously, she had a unique presence and a unique voice and a unique vision that set in place a model that in many ways has become a movement in across the globe, in different cultures, in different communities. And so the research tradition continues now, focusing on EFT with individuals. There's the Hold Me Tight program that's been used in now hospital settings with cardiac care, and there's research that's going on in that area. Continued innovation, we have studies that are happening in the Netherlands and in Canada, and applying EFFT to families. And I see this research tradition continuing to grow. Sue set the course. And as Gail was mentioning, that attachment theory and practice was the big idea, the big vision of saying this is not, relationships are not just about couples, relationships are about life, and they're relevant to individuals and they're relevant to families. And attachment gives us, attachment science gives us direction for guiding people to wholehearted living together.
It's really hard to argue with attachment as this overall unifying theory of love and relationships. Sue had told me that Bowlby had wanted to call it the theory of love instead of attachment theory, but he thought no one would take him seriously. But she really took an existing framework and a body of literature and applied it to an experiential form of therapy. And really, you can't imagine now. I often tell my students the original EFT texted, even though Sue was always passionate about attachment theory, she would tell you, but originally EFT texts did not have any attachment at all, but it now you could not separate the two. When you think of emotionally focused therapy, you think of attachment theory, and you think of Sue Johnson. We'll end here like we started. Personally, I'm wondering if you're comfortable sharing your last communication with her. I had knew she was battling cancer, and I would talk to her maybe every 2 years. We would have a brief chat, and we were was working on this common factors project that I was sitting model developers down, and I was asking, hey, you could pick any one or two people you'd like to sit down with and talk that have a different orientation. You and I had, she had consented to that project, and we were just setting up time, and she said this was probably around the first of the year, January, I talked to her, and she said if my health was permitting, and like she fought for her model and fought in life, I know she was fighting cancer and fought valiantly for about 3 years, but I'm wondering if you all could share your last communication with Sue and the last question of how you will remember her.
Gail, if you don't mind, I'll jump in. Yeah, it was, I don't think we were expecting her life to take this quick turn that it did. And so there was a sense of the conversations that I had with her over the last year and over the last several months that were an extension of an ongoing conversation about who I am, where I am in my life, what's important to me, what's important in her life and in her world. And those conversations would always start there. It would not be about EFT. It would be not be about the model. It would not be about the work that needed to be done. That was to come. But there was, it always led with connection. It always led with, Jim, sweetie, what's going on? And that always, I treasure the contact and the curiosity and the humanity of this work that we're doing, but yet how we're doing it really matters. And of course, then I think the thing that I take away from that last conversation, because I was asking her questions about the writing project and the next steps and some of this family work that Gail and I and others have been involved in. And she just expressed this ongoing, deeply felt confidence in the work that we're doing on behalf of families and the work that in some ways the stewardship of this model that we have that we're curious about and learning about. And she invited me into, and I think she invited others into this as well, is just to believe. She called out capacities in people that they didn't see and invited them to become more than who they are through the relationships that she had with them. I think that's what I'll take away. It was at the end of this podcast that we did recently, she ended it with this phrase that we like to batter around, that belonging leads to becoming. And I think that really is what I hold on deeply, is that my relationships with others can invite them into opportunities to become more and more of who they are through the relationships that we have and the love that we can share. And that was my relationship with Sue. You said something about Bowlby name his theory instead of attachment, a theory of love. And when I think about one of the things, and it was important enough for her to write a book called entitled Love Sense. But at the heart of the matter, at the end of the day, love is what Sue directed us all to. And that's not just love in a romantic sense, but it's love for others, it's love for community, it's love for yourself. And she saw the power in that, the power of love to transform a brokenness, to invite healing, to engage possibility. And I think when Gail, you were talking about belief, and that was also resonated with me, and that was the theme that I've heard over and over again, that her life touched people through the love that she had for her work, the love that she brought into her work, the love that she brought to other people, and the love that she sought to understand as a force, as a power, as a kind of spiritual reality in this world.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better. Belonging is becoming. I love that. And it is so simple, but it's so powerful on so many levels. Gail, your last conversation and how you will remember the late, great Sue Johnson.
The last few years, I had the good fortune of having a residence in Victoria where Sue was living. Sue and John were living. And so I was seeing her regularly alongside my own family there. And Sue would be going always, Gail, when are you coming back? I'm so looking forward to our next visit. We would chat and we would go for coffee. And of course, we would talk about whatever was the pressing issue in EFT. And the last conversation, we were in the kitchen and there was John and Sue and I, and we were having this lively discussion about the future course of certification in EFT, which was in this process of change. And it was lively and it was full of life. And that's exactly what I remember about Sue, is she was full of life. She sucked every moment she could out of life, and she gave back. She gave back not only to me, but to many others. But for me personally, she believed in me, and that grew me professionally. I was terrified to public speak when I first met her, and now that's all I do. And personally, she helped me grow and find relationships that were nurturing and helped me further grow. So I am forever grateful for Sue Johnson coming into my life, because it was transformational, as it is, I think, for many others.
Well, you couldn't say it any better. There's nothing I'm going to be able to say to top that, other than she also brought the two of you all together, which is great too. And you will, as long as the countless other EFT lead trainers around the world will go on to carry on the model, and we'll be talking about Sue Johnson as a pioneer of couple therapy, and not just a therapist. She reached the masses with Hold Me Tight too. I think the residents went far beyond just therapists, a way of thinking and working and emoting. And what a legacy. I cannot thank you all enough for being part of this tribute show. And again, now we'll intersperse your wonderful words about Sue with her own, and leave the listener with how Sue wanted to be remembered in her own way.
When you think of how you want to be remembered and the legacy of your work and the model, I'm curious what you want that to be. And I also want our listeners who are really hearing you for the first time, that have read your books and have only seen you in a textbook or something like that, what is another thing about you that you can't get from reading a book, a journal article, that you think is really core to who you are and how you'd like to be remembered?
I don't know. What is core? You've asked some huge questions here. What is core about me? I think what is the most core about me is that I grew up in a very small world in some ways, in a little English town, even though the pub was quite a circus. And some part of me when I was little decided that I, never mind the risk and the danger, I was going to make a big world for myself. I was going to find out how to really be alive. And I think I'm always drawn to what makes me really alive, makes me feel alive, whether it's interactions with people, which it always surprises you if you're really attuned to people. I don't want EFT to just help people become better friends or not in conflict. I want EFT to be what I think it is, actually. It's a way of growing people, bringing people, couples, when they change their relationship, they grow each other. I want EFT to be a vehicle for what Rogers said, which is therapy is supposed to be able to take people into a new sense of aliveness. That's what I've always thought in my life. And that's what we should be doing in therapy, not just addressing symptoms. We should be looking at people as wholes. In terms of legacy, I've just written a new book. It's coming out in January with Guilford, and it's Attachment Theory and Practice, EFT with individuals, couples and families. So I'm applying this to individuals. And I think my legacy, hopefully in psychotherapy, my legacy would be that emotion is incredibly powerful, and it's the therapist's friend. If you know how to use it, how to understand it, it's the most powerful route to change. And that the way forward for psychotherapy in general, not just couple and family therapy, is to base psychotherapy as a field on attachment science, to base the way we change people on who people are, our most basic nature. I would like that to be part of my legacy. I started out just wanting to understand and create a good couple therapy. Then I think it grew into me wanting to, if I'm being honest, change the field of couple therapy, because I think people desperately need help with their relationship. And if we don't do our work properly, we can actually lead them into more pain and more distress. But if you ask me now, there's also another piece, which is it's time for us as therapists to get on our bike and educate the public. It's time for us to impact society. Our society is forgetting how important relationships are and how precious and sacred they are. And it's time for us to turn and actively the public how to grow, how to deal with being alive, which terrifies all of us, how to, what we can offer them, how to understand love and loving. We have a huge amount to give in this field. We just have so much to give. I look at what I've done in the last few years. EFT, we didn't just build a model, we built a community. There's 65 EFT centers all over the world, and we build communities everywhere we go. If we can get together and connect, if we can be a team and come together as a field, we can impact this culture. We can turn people back towards valuing connection and learning how to cooperate and collaborate. If we don't connect, we're going to self-destruct. This is all a bit big, but why not go for what's big in life? That's where the aliveness is, not hedging your bet.
Eli, bringing to a close a very special tribute installment to the late, great Sue Johnson of the AAMFT podcast. Gail, Jim, again, thank you so much for your words. And the reason we did this podcast, I went to AMFT over 6 years ago and pitched this idea. I had lost my mentor, the late, great Doug Sprinkle of Purdue University of Common Factors. And the goal was to talk to as many luminaries, as we call them, the model developers, the systemic therapy rock stars, if you will, while they were still around. And there was no better choice for the first episode of the podcast 6 years ago than Sue Johnson. And thank you so much for letting us into your audio space for all these years. You can follow us. We're on where you find all your social media. Be sure to look for us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, even LinkedIn. And there's where you can stay up to date with the latest in MFT news, events, and clinical content like we feature on the show. You can get a hold of me, Eli, at NorthstarCounselingCenter.com. You can find out everything you need to know about me, including my on-demand trainings and books aimed at systemic therapists, at EliKaram.com. That's EliKaram.com. All the back installments of the podcast are including episodes 1 and 2, the two-part Sue Johnson interview, are available wherever you find your favorite podcast. I'm partial to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, but you can find them wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate a star rating and review to help us rise through the ranks of the mental health podcast. Until next time, my friends, stay safe. Stay systemic.